From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Books are a great indicator of a person's mood at the moment, and it will be interesting to learn what people are reading in the weeks after the presidential election. Some of you are going to keep with the politics theme, at least for now. You look for analysis or reflection or history that will help you make sense or cope with what happened. Some are going to want something to challenge your busy mind, so mysteries or true crime. Some are just looking for a diversion, at least for now. So you'll want a story that is sad or lovely or daring. In fact, there are a lot of books that can take your mind off politics. Recipes, graphic novels, poetry, short stories. And today in the program, whatever mood you're in, we've got you covered. It's our annual holiday book show today. Our experts from local bookstores are with us in the studio with their piles of books. So join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it's our annual holiday book show today, and I need to keep this introduction short because I know how it will go. We'll get to the end of this program. I'll look over at the stacks of books in the studio here and feel guilty that we didn't get to that one and we didn't get to that one. Of course, there are a lot of titles to consider as you're thinking about books as gifts this season. There's not a better gift than a book, and there are no better experts to help than with the group we have with us today, as always. So before we jump in, though, I should just also point out we will not, despite our efforts, get to all the books. We never do. So there will be a list on our website, and I'll remind you of that a little bit later on the program. Okay, joining us, Betsy Burton, co-owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Catherine Weller's back with us also, the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
And Ken Sanders, welcome back to you. He's the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay, so I know I shouldn't do this, and please don't take very long to answer this, but okay, it was an odd election year, and people are sort of wondering. So, how are books affecting the way they're thinking about this, or looking for diversions, or to make sense? I mean, what are you noticing? If you are noticing anything in your shops,
I think one of the things I'm noticing is right after the election, everybody wanted to escape. That's all they could think about. They wanted to buy mysteries, yeah, science fiction, whatever their choice is.
Right.
Now they're starting to say, okay, we got to face facts here, and they're going after nonfiction facts.
Yeah, yeah. Facts, okay, facts. What did you notice, Kat?
Yeah, I am interestingly seeing, and we've always been a nonfiction store, but I see more of a return to nonfiction in current affairs. It's been interesting the past several years. There hasn't been so much in books in current affairs. That seems to have been something that's moved into magazines and the blogosphere.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing people looking more towards books for that, more of a longer, deeper form. So more power to that.
Yeah.
Speaking from an antiquarian perspective, the fall has been a disaster for the sale of rare books because I think people have been afraid. And I hate to break it to all of you, but this line between fiction and nonfiction, sorry, there's no such thing anymore.
I'm going to talk about that a little later in terms of Michael Chabon.
Okay. Well, Betsy, let's start. And we'll begin with you.
But I'm not going to start with that
one. Okay, all right.
Okay. I'm going to start with three novels that I really loved. The first is Rose Tremaine, the Gustav Sonata. Rose Tremaine is wonderful in a quiet way, like Wendell Berry, who we're going to hear about from Ken. And this novel is about two best friends starting at age 5 in Switzerland right after World War II. Gustav is a boy who cannot please his mother. His father had tried to rescue Jews. It had ruined their life, according to the mother, and he can do nothing to please her. The other young boy, Antoine, is a child prodigy. This book takes them through the whole scope of their life. It's gentle, it's quiet, and in that quiet way says worlds about the world they lived in during that time. If you like quiet novels, it's beyond good.
Say the name again.
The Gustav Sonata. Also, it is very much embedded in music. Antoine is a child prodigy pianist, so musicians will love this as well.
Great.
The Underground Railroad, which I resisted. I just didn't know if I wanted to read about the Underground Railroad, which I knew from reviews was a made-up thing using the metaphor of the Underground Railroad. I thought, that's a hokey idea. And then I read it, and, you know, Cora's plight during this entire book just pulls you along by the throat. What the underground, the metaphor, the Underground Railroad and the real Underground Railroad are perfect companions to each other. I learned more about slavery and the Underground Railroad itself than I ever knew, and I thought I knew quite a bit. And it's just a great read. I dare anybody not to finish this once they've started it. Impossible to put down. Then a great read in a very different way, A Gentleman in Moscow, Amor Towles. This is escape. This is a Russian aristocrat who was attributed falsely to having written a revolutionary poem. So the Stalinists don't want to get him, but they don't want to, you know. So anyway, he's at this fabulous hotel that they keep, and they move him up to the sixth floor. And this, again, is the span of a lifetime. He's kind of a Scarlet Pimpernel character, and it's just a great read.
That's A Gentleman in Moscow, Amor Towles.
Yeah. Do I have 30 more seconds?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
Take it.
Okay, the last one, Not a New One, Everybody's Fool by Richard Russo, which continues to be one of the favorites at the store. If anybody hasn't read Nobody's Fool, they should, and if they have, they should read Everybody's Fool, which is the same characters. And my favorite is a police chief whose wife has recently died and committed adultery right before she died, and he drives around with a garage door clicker looking for the culprit. This involves grave digging, friendship, old affairs, new affairs, the best dialogue you've ever read anywhere. Somebody I know actually was reading out, a couple was reading this out loud and just loved that experience. So Everybody's Fool by Richard Russo.
Right, okay. Ken Sanders.
Turning to Utah and the Mormons, Doug, as is my wont, there's been a lot of interesting and odd books coming out on the subject. I want to start with Martha Bradley Evans's monumental biography and history of Joseph Smith, American prophet, called Glorious in Persecution. It's published by the Smith Pettit Foundation. It's a massive new look. It's much more than just a biography. It's a really early history of the LDS Church, maybe in, I hate to say it, but in the same sense as Von Brody's No Man Knows My History way back in the 1940s. It's published in the Smith Pettit Foundation, the Signature Book Series, which I think are doing some of our finest scholarly and objective history, really trying to look historically at early Mormonism and what it is. Highly recommend it.
Say the name again. Is it
Glorious in Persecution, Joseph Smith, American Prophet, 1839 to 1844.
Okay. Okay.
Turning to old hand William McKinnon, he has issued in the famous Arthur Clarke Mormon series, Kingdom in the West, At Swords Point, Part 2. A documentary history of the Utah War. It's such a big subject, even though it only took place over 1857 to 58, that he had to do two 500-page books to cover it. This is out of sequence for the Clark series. This, we don't know when Will Bagley will ever quit with this series.
He will never quit.
So they're up.
I assure you, he will never quit.
So this is volume 11, but they're up to 15 or 16 already because this fills a hole. So all you completist collectors can rest at ease now. You can fill in the hole in this series. Again, great early historical Mormon publishing from a 100-plus-year-old publisher, the Arthur Clarke Company.
And he's a terrific writer.
He's terrific.
Yeah.
In the odd sense of things, we have secret combinations, evidence of early Mormon counterfeiting, 1800 to 1847. This has got nothing to do with Mark Hoffman, okay? But again, it's maybe a bit dry, maybe a bit academic, but if you're interested in the subject of historical Mormon forgeries, this one is totally, totally there.
Wait, so there are more than just – so there's a deep history of forgeries in Mormonism.
Oh, yeah, going way, way back. And like I say, it might be a little bit dry, but for the information, it's well worth the
read. Okay, so this is – okay.
My apologies to the author for that critique. On a completely different subject, Scott Thibone has written a book called The Disappearances, a story of exploration, murder, and mystery in the American West. Newsflash, that in November of 1934, there was more than just one white guy from Hollywood that disappeared near Escalante, Utah, a.k.a. Everett Roos. And this book doesn't lie about Everett Roos, as perhaps other books in the past claiming to have discovered him did.
Don't get him started.
I'll leave it at that.
Right.
There was a young girl, a teenage girl from back east. There was another adult male. And in 1934, all three of them disappeared in a tiny area of unpopulated southeastern Utah. How weird is that? Scott Thibone, National Geographic and other mainstream national writer, has published this great account of mysteries in southeastern Utah, published by our own University of Utah Press, The Disappearances by Scott Thibone.
Great. That sounds great. Okay, Catherine.
Okay, well, as is my wont, and I don't know what this says about me, I'm turning to a book in which somebody hikes off into the wilderness to be alone.
Continuing the theme.
It's a lovely, quiet book, and one of the things, as we've talked about people wanting to escape, this is not escaping into fiction. This is escaping into a different kind of reality in a very real situation. This is somebody escaping into the Bob Marshall Wilderness up in Montana, which is a very, very deep, dark wilderness. This is a place which has more grizzly bears per, I don't know, however you want to measure it, square mile, foot, whatever, than anywhere else in the continental United States. They're just everywhere. This is a place through which this author has to hike every day. The trees are so thick there. He calls it the Hansel and Gretel stretch. He can't see between the trees. As a person from the Mountain West, this desert Mountain West, some of his descriptions just make my skin crawl because I am so overcome with claustrophobia.
Yeah.
But the beauty and the quiet and the transcendence, the transcendence is just so absolutely lovely in this book. And it's not over the top writing. Even though I just used transcendence in that way, it is just quiet, lovely prose about a month that this man spends in the wilderness, interlaid with his initial experiences with the wilderness as a river ranger 20 years earlier. The piece that we have to hear from is him reading from a program called Think Out Loud. It's his initial day alone in the wilderness. He has had to ride in on horseback with two other handlers and a bunch of fish eggs that he is going to babysit for a month while they hatch, and then they can be released out into the river to ostensibly turn into fish and not be eaten by other fish and other animals. This is his first day alone, and he's out hiking alone for the first time, missing his boys, missing his wife, and wondering how he is going to make it.
What is it that, before we play this, what is it that you like about this clip? What I think is interesting is he decides not to explore something. And that
right.
was the part that you really like?
What I like is that it shows this this quirkiness of his personality.
It's not really restrained.
This weird view he has of how he is going to explore this piece of the world he has entirely to himself for the next month.
Yeah. Okay, great. Here it is. This is from The Names of the Stars by Peter Fromm. It's a reading that he gave, as Kat mentioned, on a public radio program produced in Oregon.
But instead of climbing up the dam or trekking around it to the high ground, the run a lodgepole curbing the south side, I hesitate, simply stand before it. I don't know if it's obsession or habit or simply a superstition, my own rabbit's foot to rub, or something that actually makes sense. But in my time in the wilds, I've learned to always hold something in reserve, something for when things might get harder. So snowshoeing along the Selway at 20 below, I'd leave my jacket a bit unzipped or carry my hat in my pocket, something saved for when it got colder, for where the wind picked up. Or rounding a mountain lake, stooping down to search for skipping stones, I'd find the perfect skipper, an aerodynamic marvel. Instead of launching it, I'd pocket it, skip all its inferior rivals instead, saving the perfect stone for the perfect time, the perfect place. Maybe it made no sense at all. Maybe it was all a holdout from childhood, stretching and stretching the Halloween candy until, in December, I'd have to hold the last stale Tootsie Rolls in my mouth a while just to soften them enough to bite into. Now here, my first day in, I don't want to discover everything yet. I want, as always, more and more. And I pocket the chance to explore the mother of all beaver ponds for a later, maybe harder day. Just something in reserve to hold on to anticipate and savor.
It's Peter Fromm from the book The Names of the Stars, one of Kat's favorite of the year. So, great. Kat, thank you. All right. Catherine Weller is from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Betsy Burton, you heard from there earlier, from the King's English at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Ken Sanders also with us on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. He owns Ken Sanders Rare Books. We'll take a break. I'll mention a list of all of these books that we talk about and that we didn't get to will be on our website, radiowest.org. Here's a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we've gathered our group of experts from local bookstores to go through the novels and mysteries and biographies and whatever else that you're considering for your list this season. It's one of those we mentioned that you may need a pen for. If not, it's okay because we have a list of all of this on our website. All right. We have with us Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton with the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks, and we're going to start this round with Ken.
In the speaking of something else department, Doug,
okay.
I'm going to go wordless, and I don't mean that literally because that's inconceivable, but I want to talk about wordless novels, and since this is a radio show, I'm going to have to tell, not show. White Collar by Jacome Patry was one of the greatest of the wordless novels that came out of the Great Depression, only nobody knew it. It took him 10 years to hand make the book. And by then it was 1939, and we were coming out of the Great Depression. He lost his shirt and everything else in doing it. And it finally was published in a tiny handmade edition. Finally, we have a quality hardbound edition of the wordless novel the way that Patry conceived it. It's no longer a homemade book, as it says, but the beauty of it is, in this iteration, it's, see if I can find the start of it here, it has both orange woodblock prints or lino cuts, actually they're linoleum blocks rather than wood, it begins in the Great Depression of 1929, as I said, and the orange artwork depicts the fantasy world that the author is living during the Great Depression, and the black woodcuts depict the reality of the Great Depression. And it goes back and forth between the fantasy and the real world of the Depression. And I think, along with Lynn Ward's God's Man, it's one of the greatest wordless novels, and it's finally available in an affordable an in-print edition after, you know, a half a century or more.
It's called White Collar.
White Collar, by novel and lino cuts by Jacome Patry. Along the same vein, Art Spiegelman, the famous Art Spiegelman, has rediscovered another lost wordless novel called Cy Lewin's Parade that was one of the last of the original novels actually issued in 1950. And he's chosen to have it done in this folding accordion style format that makes it very difficult to show to you. And it's very, very different from White Collar, but again, it's a completely wordless novel, and through these very large pictures, it tells this remarkable story. And, of course, I, as you well know, am obsessed by novels without words, or the wordless novels, or whatever you choose to call them. And so they're two of my picks.
Say the
picks.
Name of this title again.
Cy Lewin's Parade. A great pick. Kudos to Art Spiegelman for rediscovering it. It isn't one that I had ever found on my own yet.
Wow.
And also, I have to mention, because we're speaking of offbeat stuff, our very own Sinosopher, Alex Caldiero, and the newly formed Salt Front Press has issued their very first book. Yay to local authors and local publishers. This is a journal that Caldiero kept of a river trip down Cataract Canyon some years ago, where he was the writing teacher and all of the participants on the trip were women. This is the first and only river trip Alex has ever taken in his life. There won't be another one. He hated the entire experience, and this is his diary of why. It begins with words to the effect of, "Why does being in nature always have to feel so unnatural?" I wished I could do Caldiero better than that.
That's a pretty good Caldiero. Okay, who is the dancer? What is the dance?
I forgot the name.
It's the name of the title. Yes, there it is. Okay. Betsy Burton.
Reedy. It's one of the funniest things he's ever written.
Wow, great. Okay, Betsy.
Okay, so this is my favorite book of the year. It's called Moonglow. It's by Michael Chabon. And he is a wonderful writer, wonderfully magical storyteller at the best of times, and this is the best of times in his life. The odd thing about this book is that it is a novel that's also a memoir, and it goes back and forth. The frame of the book is a grandfather telling his grandson his story from his deathbed. The grandson is Michael Chabon. He is, in fact, a writer who is two generations off this man. And the man really is unleashed by drugs and by a wish to tell the tale. But the thing that's so interesting about this book and compelling is the man himself, the grandfather. He is a wonderful character. His life is absolutely fascinating. Starting out raised in South Philly, he's ODD and, you know, he just doesn't fit in. And he's absolutely fascinated by space and rockets. It's all he cares about. Then he gets married to a woman with severe mental problems who he loves. So there's a love story in this. But the real story is he goes to war. He's recruited by Wild Bill Donovan. He's part of the OSS. He's looking for rocketry technology during the war. And one of his idols is Wernher von Braun, because he, like our grandfather, is reaching for the stars and the moon. And then he goes to, just as the war winds down, he goes to Nordhausen and he sees this Holocaust, evidence of horror that he can't believe. He knows von Braun was complicit in this and knew about it. And so he now wants to kill him, wants nothing as much as to kill him. And there is another issue that he has to pursue something else. And the war is over, and the rest of this wonderful book takes place, and it's near the end of the book, near the end of both of their lives. He's at a conference in Florida, and he hears something next door, and he peers over the partition, and Wernher von Braun has just accepted an award. They've never seen each other. The reader doesn't know what our grandfather is about to do. The audience leaves von Braun, goes into the back room, and as this scene plays itself out, grandfather is watching von Braun from the next room.
This is a reading read by the actor George Newbern.
Oh. Von Braun's gaze lighted on a tall ficus and a pumpkin-shaped terracotta pot in the corner opposite him. He moved toward the potted plant with a hitch in his gait. He unzipped the fly of his brown suit trousers and took out his pallid old nozzle. There was a pattering, the first drops of rain hitting a dirt infield, then a fitful sloshing like somebody after a party pouring the dregs of beer bottles onto the lawn. Von Braun groaned and cursed softly to himself in the most scabrous German my grandfather had heard since the war. His own urinary vigor was no longer what it once was, and he felt an automatic pity for von Braun. The conqueror of the moon kept at it, and after a minute or two it was clear from the acoustics that he had himself a puddle. He coaxed out another laggard drop or two and then hunched his shoulders to zip himself up. My grandfather forgot that he was supposed to keep trying to keep out of Von Braun's way. When Von Braun turned from the ficus tree, he saw my grandfather looking at him over the partition. Von Braun looked more embarrassed, certainly more contrite, than my grandfather would have expected. He felt his long-nurtured hatred of the man begin to waver. After all, how was the case of Von Braun different from that of any other man whose greatness was chiefly the fruit of his ambition, that reliable breeder of monsters?
So he sees him at this surprising, vulnerable moment, and what, he's kind of humanized.
And it's a moment of old age, and this book is about, among other things, looking from old age. But this is also, I thought, a very timely quote.
Betsy, thanks. That's Moon Glow by Michael Chabon. Catherine Weller.
Well, I have to say a hearty hear here to Moon Glow. It was on my list, too, and definitely one of the best novels of the year. It's through and through just fantastic on every level.
By one of our finest writers.
Yeah. I think one of his finest efforts.
Definitely. Wow. Yeah, I remembered last night about his, he even referenced, good heavens, Thomas Pynchon.
He did?
In the Nordhausen part. In the beginning, there was a screaming. It was just fantastic. So, moving on. A Gambler's Anatomy by Jonathan Lethem. I'll be quick with this. It's a bit older now, but what a fine book from Lethem. A little bit different. Not quite as magical, not quite as strange as some of his other books.
Very different.
But different in its own way. This is the story of a man who is a backgammon hustler who gets a tumor, and it changes him. It changes him in so many ways, as tumors in one's brain do. And he ends up going to a very strange land called the Bay Area, where he is kind of the hostage of charity. He gets an operation that frees things up, but complicates things utterly in other ways. This has trademark Lethem tropes, you know, the strange names, the strange beings, the counterculture, the weird, almost supernatural thing, which in this case is the tumor, and what it exacts from people who are involved with it and the gambler. It is in its own way a magical book and well worth picking up if you are a fan of Lethem. And I think a good introduction to Lethem. I think it's the closest to Motherless Brooklyn that we've seen recently.
Yeah, he's great.
Next on my fiction list is Francine Prose's latest, called Mr. Monkey, an odd novel that pivots off of a children's play, a dreadful off Broadway play called Mr. Monkey, which is interrupted one day in the middle by one of those moments that only children provide, where a child says too loudly, and he knows it's too loudly as soon as he says it. He says, "Grandpa, are you interested in this?" And the whole thing just stops for a moment. Each chapter of this book is told from the perspective of somebody who's involved with that play, an actor, the child, a teacher of the child. And it takes them through their lives in Brooklyn, in New York. It's really a satire of modern life in the way that only Francine Prose can do it. She is really turning into a marvelous novelist, great characters, great pacing. She is really somebody to watch in the future. Very quickly, because I am running out of time, Mr. Monkey by Francine Prose, a deeply, deeply strange novel called Memoirs of a Polar Bear by Yoko Tawada, which is actually the memoirs of a family of three polar bears, the matriarch, her daughter, and her daughter's son. Well, the matriarch gets a desk job after she retires from the circus. This is magical and lyrical. It is deeply strange in the best possible way. And really, you should read this book.
Say the name again.
Memoirs of a Polar Bear by Yoko Tawada.
Okay. All right. All right, well, let's take a break. That was Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Betsy Burton is with us, of course, from King's English, and we have Ken Sanders from Ken Sanders Rare Books. A list to all of this, all of these titles, and the ones we won't get to, which we never do get to all of them, will be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. All right, another quick break, and back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with our group of experts talking about books. They're giving you ideas, titles for books as gifts. It's the perfect gift, of course. Ken Sanders is with us. Betsy Burton is with us. Catherine Weller also with us. We have a list of all of the books that we'll get to and the ones we won't on our website. All right, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books.
Well, Doug, you know, I don't think there's any question that we're living in strange and interesting times. And with what's been going on in the country, and I think what's going to be going on in the future, I think we need to turn back to our poets for some clarity. We've got Huxley and Brave New World, and we've got Orwell in 1984, and we've got Margaret Atwood and Handmaid's Tale and all the rest. We got Philip K. Dick. We've got a lot of futurists. We've got, for crying out loud, we can go back to Sinclair Lewis, and It Can't Cap an Ear in 1936. But what's going to explain what's going to happen to us in the future? To my mind, it's pretty clear because your profession, reporting, journalism, whatever you want to call it, that's gone. That's just going to be out the window because we've entered an era where you just get to make stuff up and you just repeat it over and over again, and this becomes a new reality. And I'm going to shut up about that because I could go on for weeks on it. But I'm sorry, but it's true, and we're going to have to fight back somehow. And as I think one of our greatest writers, poets, and soothsayers of the future living in America today, Wendell Berry, I want to read one short poem of his from a collection called Leavings that was published a few years ago. It's called Questionnaire by Wendell Berry. 1. How much poison are you willing to eat for the success of the free market and global trade? Please name your preferred poisons. 2. For the sake of goodness, how much evil are you willing to do? Fill in the following blanks with the names of your favorite evils and acts of hatred. 3. What sacrifices are you prepared to make for culture and civilization? Please list the monuments, shrines, and works of art you would most willingly destroy. 3. In the name of patriotism and the flag, how much of our beloved land are you willing to desecrate? List in the following spaces, the mountains, rivers, towns, farms, you could most readily do without. 5. State briefly the ideas, ideals, or hopes, the energy sources, the kinds of security for which you would kill a child. Name, please, the children you would be willing to kill. Questionnaire by Wendell Berry.
Wow.
I spoke with Wendell. I heard him read that on one of your colleagues, Terry Gross's show on Fresh Air when it was new. And I happened to talk to Wendell on the phone a few days after that. And I said, Wendell, where on earth did that poem come from? And he paused for a moment, and then in that long Kentucky drawl of his, he says, well, Ken, it's what happens to a fella when you write a poem when you're really, really angry.
Where could someone find that poem, by the way?
In the collection Leavings by Wendell Berry, Available in hardbound and paperback.
Great, okay. Ken, thanks. Catherine Weller.
So I'm trying to figure out what to start with to pivot off of that. I just don't know where to go.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with How to Survive a Plague by David France.
Seems right.
Yeah. This is...
One plague to another.
This is such a good book. It's just a wonderful book. David France did an Oscar-nominated documentary on the AIDS crisis. And this book is an expansion that, believe it or not, well, of course it does. It's a book. It goes deeper and does better than that documentary, which was amazing. If you remember back in the day, the Randy Schultz book and the band played on, this is the band played on for this time and this place. It is absolutely phenomenal. It starts, again, at the very beginning of the AIDS crisis with the very early findings of the Kaposi's sarcoma in New York City, and then the poppings up in San Francisco. The doctors who were first seeing it and bucking the medical field, trying to figure out what was going on. The infighting in the gay community itself as to how to approach it, and then the infighting in the medical community. Never mind the cultural landscape of America that said this was a problem. No, it isn't a problem. No, it's really a gift from God to wipe out this scourge upon our country. It takes one very viscerally back to just the horror of the late 70s and early 80s, and how that was turned into, I hesitate to say a victory, but how it was turned into a cultural victory, how the gay movement was not quashed, but was able to cohese and to turn into something larger and bigger and better, how it really changed medicine and the approach to medicine, and changed a lot of politics. It is just a wonderful book in so many ways for history of medicine, cultural history, American history. It's deep and wonderful. How to Survive a Plague by David France. Also, Cultural History, Trainwreck by Sadie Doyle. This is subtitled The Women We Love to Hate, Mock and Fear, and Why. Ultimately, this is about the fallen woman. You know, it starts with Mary Wollstonecraft, and it ends with Britney Spears, and it goes in between there. It is all of those women that we really like to make a lot of fun of. It's men who live large. You know, that's okay. We admire them in a way, but we really love to tear down the women that live large and challenge society. And what Sadie Doyle does, aside from talk about that, what she does that's really brilliant is she talks about how that really is a larger lens. Those women hold up a mirror to society, and they really show us what we are struggling with at that moment, how they are showing us our issues, really. And we need to pay attention to how we are critiquing these train wrecks, because really, those are the problems we're having right now as a society. It's a very nicely done book. The women she treats in it are just fantastic.
Trainwreck again.
Trainwreck by Sadie Doyle. Lastly, the Voynich manuscript is such a weird, weird, weird thing. It was discovered by a manuscripts and rare book dealer in 1912, and the manuscript is named for that dealer, Mr. Voynich. It was made in the 15th century for reasons we don't know. Nobody has been able to decipher it, and there are numerous conspiracy theories abounding about this. Nobody has been able to decode it. Nobody can understand it. Artists love the Voynich manuscript. Conspiracy theorists love the Voynich manuscript. People write about it. People speculate on it to this day. And Yale University Press has put out this magnificent facsimile of the Voynich manuscript with plenty of gatefolds so you can really open it up and look at the strange plants and constellations in here. It has lots of essays about it. When Umberto Eco went to the Beinecke Library, the one manuscript in all of the Beinecke he wanted to see was the Voynich manuscript.
Wow. Wow. So. Terrific. Great. Okay. All right, Betsy.
Okay, I'm going to talk about gift books, and I'm going to give you a couple of three-in-ones. The first one is for anyone who loves Shakespeare. You wrap up Hagseat by Margaret Atwood, E. McEwen's Nutshell, and The Girl from Venice by Martin Cruz Smith, and what you have is three retellings of three Shakespeare plays. And they couldn't be better retellings. Martin Cruz Smith's is a retelling of Hamlet, and the narrator of this little piece is a not-quite-full-term fetus listening to his mother plot the death of his father with Uncle Claude. Then there's Hagseed. Margaret Atwood is a retelling of The Tempest, and it's a theater director who's been betrayed and is thinking of revenge and is now wound up in a prison teaching Shakespeare to felons. And the only way he can get them to be involved in Shakespeare is to retell the plays in rap. And it is just magnificent. By the end of the book, you love every felon in the book. And The Girl from Venice, Martin Cruz Smith, a very dark thriller writer who tells the tale of a young woman floating on the water, seaweed in her hair, purple lips, obviously dead. He pulls her out, and it is Kate from Taming of the Shrew. And the tale involves Nazis and fascists and derring do and planes and gold, and it's just a great read. And it is Taming of the Shrew with a little Two Gentlemen of Verona thrown in. So a ribbon around the three two books is a great Christmas gift. Then another threesome that is a great Christmas gift is March. Anthony Lewis's biography, which is also the biography of the civil rights movement. And the thing I want to say about this, it is a graphic novel, so perfect for high schoolers, perfect for adults, easy to read. But it also is a perfect book for a person of my age to give their grandchild of about 12 or 13 and read with them. It just couldn't be a better kind of present for a grandparent to give a grandchild and to then talk about. It's just astonishing.
Say the name again.
It's March by Anthony Lewis. And I have to say that this is very timely. We need to know about the civil rights movement and about the struggles of people of different cultures and colors. Then very quickly, Anthony Bourdain, Appetites, if you want to be cheered up, buy Appetites. Anthony Bourdain, as you know, travels all over the world, but he's at home here. He is writing for his wife and daughter, and so he really tells you how to cook an omelet and do some very kind of easy things. But he also has exotic recipes, and he also is hysterically funny, and you don't want to give it to your great aunt Hattie. For instance, on the dessert page, we won't say what he says, except it starts with an F, dessert. And then he has a picture of Stilton and a spoon. That's his idea of the right dessert.
I have an Aunt Hattie.
Is that right? Don't give this. Well, maybe you could give it to her. I don't know. You're Aunt Hattie.
I could.
Great. Okay, Betsy, thanks. Okay. All right, so we're going to jump into some. We're running out of time, but okay. We'll get to these children's books. And we're going to start with Betsy. Jump back in.
Okay. Well, I thought this year I ought to bring up a board book, so I went walking. It's not new. Sue Williams and Julie Vivas, who writes, has these wonderfully joyful illustrations, which, and it's I Went Walking. What did you see? I saw a black cat, and she sees all these animals in the last page. I Went Walking. What did you see? A lot of animals following me. And a very different take on kind of the same subject, They All Saw a Cat, is a cat and all of the animals all around who see this cat in very different ways, from a flea to a mouse to et cetera, et cetera. Then a wonderful Christmas book is Refuge. We know the story of Mary Joseph and the baby Jesus going to the stable, but we don't think about what happens after that. What happens after that is they make their way to Egypt, to refuge. They are refugees, and I can't think of a better book for the season than this one. And then finally, The Inquisitor's Tale by Adam Gidwitz, and wonderfully, not illustrated, but illuminated by Hatim Ali, is about three children and a dog
all of them different, all of them trying to protect each other, looking for safety, and also this is a tale about books, about a Christian world in the Middle Ages which didn't allow other viewpoints and burned books and people based on that. It is just a great read. Like Michael Chabon, it's a great read, and recommend it highly to anybody who likes kids'
books. Say the name again.
The Inquisitor's Tale.
Okay, Catherine.
Okay, so I can't tell you how many times in the past several years I've had somebody coming in saying, I want a book like The Way Things Work that has computers in it. Well, this year they redid The Way Things Work again, and it has computers in it.
Great.
So not only do we have Woolly Mammoth doing submarines and steam power, but we have remote control units and 3D printers and mag-level trains. So all of the modern things as well as the classic things from The Way Things Work in the same level of explanation that makes him so fantastic. Steve Jenkins, he's my favorite juvenile science guy. Animals by the Numbers, this is entirely infographic, so it's the perfect gift for your nerdy nephew. Lifespans long and short, the lengths of tongues, defensive mechanisms, all with his great, great illustrations that are so colorful and lively, but it's facts. It's facts in the way they love. And one of our store favorites is The Lost House, a seek and find book by B.B. Cronin. And this is like a smarter Where's Waldo that is so vibrant. Each page is a different palette that just leaps off the page at you. And the whole shtick is these kids have to help Granddad get ready to take them out to the park. They have to help him find his glasses and his dentures and et cetera, et cetera. And whoops, you find the wrong glasses for him. Those are pink. You have to go back. It took us weeks and weeks to find the man's teeth. The New York Times reviewer still hadn't found his teeth when they went to press.
That's great.
It's wonderful.
That's terrific. Okay, great. All right, Ken.
Doug, as you know, I live in the past, you know, and I think in these troubled times, I'm going to go totally with taking comfort out of children's classics. We can't barely but scratch the surface, but the list is really extensive of them. Madeline Lee Angle started out with one of my favorite of my own childhood books, A Wrinkle in Time, Wind in the Door, Swiftly Tilting Planet. The trilogy, I think, is at least up to 8 or 9 books now. Mm-hmm. Roald Dahl, yeah, we know about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and some of his others, but what about The Twits? That seems an appropriate title for now. The Magic Finger, I can think of a use for that one. And all these fantastic Mr. Fox. It's endless. I mean, Andrew Lang's fairy tale books, 12 different colored fairy tale books done 100 years ago. So there's none of this modern revisionist stuff in it. It's all the pure good old stuff before they watered it down for children. The Oz books. I mean, there's nothing wrong with Harry Potter and J.R.R. Tolkien and all the rest, but there's 40 different Oz books, and it will really transport you. It's so much more than just the movie. And we've got Dr. Seuss, and we've got Shel Silverstein, and we've got, you know, the Mary Norton's The Borrowers, and we've got it. It's endless, 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 and we could just go on and on and on. And so I'm really recommending going back to the roots and the classic children books, and there's thousands and thousands of them, and I think ourselves, our children, our grandchildren can take a lot of comfort out of them in these troubled, unsettled, weird times.
Okay. All right. We're not doing badly.
No.
We have time for a lightning round. It seems like we never do. Okay, so let's just sort of go 1, 2, 3. You guys just do one title at a time. We'll see what
one
we can get through. Betsy, you want to start?
Okay, I'll start with News of the World, another wonderful read by Paulette Giles. The main plot of the story is a man who reads the news. He's a Civil War veteran. He's taking to what he thinks of as safety a young girl who's been kidnapped by the Kiowa. It's a rollicking Western read. You can't put it down, and it's seriously well written.
Quick title again.
News of the World.
Got it. Cat.
Dory's Cookies by Dory Greenspan. This is a great gift for the baker in your life. It will change the way you think about cookies. Not only does she do everything you love, she does things you've never thought of, like savory cookies. they actually turn out pretty well. Big, beautiful pictures. It's food porn, but it's recipes that work, too.
Great. So. Dory's Cookies. All right.
Utah and the Great War, the Beehive State and the World War I Experience, edited by Alan Kent Powell. As far as I know, the really first book-length history of what World War I meant to the state of Utah.
Great.
Okay, Ingredienti by Marcella Hazan and her husband, Victor Hazan, who compiled it after her death, is a book about ingredients with wonderful little line drawings and tells you everything you ever thought you didn't know about, everything from olive oil to pasta to turnips to beets. Wonderful to read and a perfect gift for people who like to cook.
Plant Exploring the World. This is a big art
Look
book from Fiden. Lovely reproductions of botanical illustrations from various times and places, artists across the world. This is one of those books that you just sit and look through over and over again.
That looks a little like the John Darien, which is also about those
Indeed.
Kinds of prints.
Yeah.
He's terrific. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
No one has yet to mention a mystery today, so Lee Child, has got a brand, Lee Child has got a brand new Jack Reacher novel just out called Night School. It's
Do you like
great.
The Reacher series?
Everything about him except I'll never see the movie because
okay,
Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher, sorry, not happening.
But they've become a little formulaic, but this is back before.
This is the early,
back
to the early days.
Yeah. Okay,
and
good.
Just one quickly, we were talking about briefly Umberto Eco.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
got a great new novel out too called The Prague Cemetery, Umberto Eco.
Okay, like 30 seconds left.
Okay.
Go.
The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate. This written by a German forester, and it's everything you never knew about trees and how they coexist.
Yeah. We're trying to get him.
I'm going to wrap back to a recommendation of Ken's from last time. If you didn't read it yet, you need to read The Mirror Thief and Give It as a Gift by Martin Say.
Hmm. From Mormon to Mermaid, One Woman's Voyage from Oppression to Freedom, a memoir by Laura Lay.
Quite a title.
Betsy, you said what your favorite was. It was the Chabon book.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you, like, second? What was your like, I'm looking for favorites, just quickly.
Well, I did, you know, the Gustav Sonata probably is my next favorite, but I also just love The Underground Railroad.
Okay. What was your favorite?
My favorite novel is hands down Moonglow by Chabon. My favorite nonfiction is the AIDS book.
Yeah.
Yep.
White Collar and Leavings.
Okay, great. Oh, good job, you guys. Ken Sanders owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton. The King's English at 15th and 15th. Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good job. List of the books we mentioned, even the ones we didn't get to, it's available on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Emily Anderson. We have technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.